Suzanne. Good evening, dear friends. Welcome to our gathering of Peaceful Refuge Sangha and Tiger Mountain Sangha and friends. Very nice to see you here. Let's take a minute and just look at the flowers in our garden. And soak in for a minute just what it means to be here. Why you came, why you're here. And imagining all your Sangha siblings feeling similarly. Already the world seems like a better place. So as we gather tonight, we're going to have a period of sitting meditation and then a talk. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to share the Dharma. It's very special to me. So let's start by finding the perfect posture for us to sit in tonight. Get in touch with your body. Find a place where it's relaxed and alert, can be still for the next few minutes of time, comfortable and at ease. Your feet on the floor or a cushion, your bum on a seat of the chair or a cushion. And just allow with the next exhale your body to sink down a little bit, to let go of needing to hold yourself upright. Let gravity do its work for you. And just relax. We're going to start with reading the Great Bell Chant, and then we'll go into a silent meditation. May the sound of this bell penetrate deep into the cosmos. Even in the darkest spots, living beings are able to hear it clearly, so that all suffering in them cease. Understanding comes to their hearts, and they transcend the path of sorrow and death. The universal Dharma door is already open. The sound of the rising tide is heard clearly. The miracle happens. A beautiful child appears in the heart of a lotus flower. One single drop of this compassionate water is enough to bring back the refreshing spring to our mountains and rivers. Listening to the bell, I feel the afflictions in me begin to dissolve. My mind calm, my body relaxed, a smile is born on my lips. Following the sound of the bell, my breath brings me back to the safe island of mindfulness. In the garden of my heart, the flowers of peace bloom beautifully. So you might want to take a minute or two to stretch and to hydrate, whatever you need to make your body happy. So, dear friends, many of you know what we've been doing this year, which is to explore and practice and study the sutra on the full awareness of breathing, the Anapanasati Sutra. And we started the year with the first four exercises. The sutras contain 16 exercises. And the first four are focused on the body. And then in the second quarter, we focused on feelings, the second four exercises. And now we enter the arena of practicing with the mind, with mental formations. And first, I want to share with you a document that I found in my files that was given to us when Robert and I went on a 3-week retreat to Plum Village, and Tai was teaching on the sutra. So this is an outline of the 16 exercises of breathing, handwritten by Tai. I hope that you can see it. Can you see that? That's Tai's handwriting. So the four exercises that we're going to work with tonight are breathing in, I am aware of my mind. Breathing out, I am aware of my mind. That's the ninth. The tenth exercise is breathing in, I make my mind happy. Breathing out, I make my mind happy. The 11th exercise is breathing in, I concentrate my mind. Breathing out, I concentrate my mind. And the 12th exercise is breathing in, I liberate my mind. Breathing out, I liberate my mind. So I want to share with you some direct teaching from Tai on these exercises because he's taught so skillfully and so many times on these sutra, and also on two aspects of early Buddhist teachings, which he includes, and they give us skillful ways to develop how to live with more joy and less suffering. These are simple and practical teachings. And when I first learned them, I thought to myself both, aha, and duh, because they seem so obvious, but they're so profound. These are the teachings on the mind and store consciousness, and the teachings on right diligence. So both of these, or neither of them, may be familiar to you. I noticed that exercises 10, 11, and 12 reflect the three seals of Plum Village: mindfulness, concentration, and insight. So we start with awareness of mind, of the mind's content and habits, which can teach us so much about ourselves. Then we learn how to make our mind happy and to develop concentration, which is a secret of happiness, and then to liberate our mind, to be free to choose what is good, nourishing, and helpful. As Homo sapiens sapiens, we know that we have metacognition, the ability to be aware of what we're thinking. This ability literally defines us. It's our name in the pantheon of species, so it must be important. And yet, I never had any instruction in my many years of schooling about this ability, how to use it, or what it means for my development, for making my way in the world. Just one of the many reasons I need the Dharma to help me figure out this life. Dharma teacher Willa Blythe Baker says, Mindfulness meditation is a metacognitive activity in the sense that it's a process of getting deeply familiar with the workings of one's own mind, body, and emotional self. But in meditation, the primary aim is not to think about thinking. Instead, we cultivate a steady attention that not only pays attention, but also knows that it is paying attention. In other words, there's a reflexive quality to attention that becomes a host for all the experiences that unfold in the field of our immediate experience. Perhaps we could call this self-aware gaze meta-attention. To me, this is a good description of how we hold our attention. When we're aware of where we're putting our attention, we hold that awareness lightly. It's the context for what is happening with this breath and this breath. It adds another layer, deeper layer to our experience without complicating it. It gives a larger context to our life without adding to the story. In Michael Pollan's newest book on consciousness called A World Appears, he describes the work of a Bulgarian-born psychologist, Kalina Kristof Hagelieva. Now note, I'm afraid that I might be butchering the pronunciation of her name, so as I read this quote, I'm going to refer to her as CH. Pollan says, in an attempt to pin down the unconscious origins of our conscious thoughts, CH conducted an experiment with long-term mindfulness practitioners. These are people who have been trained to still their minds, but also to notice the precise moment when that stillness is broken by an errant thought, which CH found happens every 10 to 20 seconds or so, even in these trained minds. The big lesson of meditation, she said, is that the mind cannot be controlled. So we can give ourselves a break if we can't maintain focus beyond counting to three or so. Pollan describes her experiment. Volunteers were instructed to meditate while inside the tube of an fMRI machine and press a button whenever a thought arose. CH and her colleagues noted a jump in activity within the hippocampus, a key component of the default mode network that's involved in not only memory, but also learning and spatial navigation. They might have predicted this location, but not the timing. To their surprise, the leap in hippocampal activity preceded the arrival of the thought in the meditator's consciousness by nearly 4 seconds, an epoch in brain time, and far longer than it takes for sensory impressions to cross the threshold of our awareness. Something is going on prior to awareness, CH said, but she's not exactly sure what it is or why it takes so long. This finding indicates that a spontaneous thought must undergo some sort of complicated unconscious processing before finding or forcing its way into the stream of consciousness. We seem to be just starting to uncover another huge mystery in how our bodies and minds work. We know that we can become aware of our thoughts and feelings, of what's arising in our mind consciousness. Our body gives us signals, and as we practice listening to our bodies, we can learn what's going on inside of us even before it comes completely to awareness. When we bring our curiosity and our full attention to this process, we can learn a lot about ourselves. Tai says our thoughts and feelings flow like a river. If we try to stop the flow of a river, we will meet the resistance of the water. It's better to flow with it, and then we may be able to guide it in ways we want it to go. So we'll start with exercise 9, aware of the mind. So the 9th exercise is to be aware of what happens in our mind. Our bodies are physical formations made of many things. A flower is a physical formation. When we look into a flower, we see the flower is made of many elements, none of which is called flower. When the conditions of sun, water, soil, and heat come together with the flower seed and the gardener, a flower can manifest. So the flower is a physical formation made of many non-flower elements. Our minds are made of mental formations, also made of many things from our environment, like awareness, perceptions, ancestral inheritance, family dynamics, religious beliefs, etc. In the early Yogacara teachings of Buddhism, there's the teaching on mind consciousness and store consciousness. Thay taught this by making a circle with a horizontal line across the center. He labeled the upper section living room and the lower portion basement. The living room is called mind consciousness, and the basement is store consciousness. When you drive your car, you can drive pretty much with store consciousness. Your attention may be totally absorbed in a project, or in the past, or in the future, and yet store consciousness is capable of driving without getting into an accident. In our daily life, store consciousness handles much of our routine daily activities. When we sleep without dreaming or are in a coma, mind consciousness is not operating at all, but store consciousness keeps us alive. Buddhist meditation is an attempt to integrate mind consciousness in every moment of daily life. We want to be aware of what's going on. When we walk, we want to be aware that we're walking. When we eat, we want to be aware that we're eating. The energy of mindfulness, smriti, helps us be aware of what is going on in the present moment within us and without us. We are aware of what's happening in our body, in our feelings, and in our mind. And we are aware of what's happening outside us, in our environment, without filtering our perceptions through the lens of our personal agenda, our needs, beliefs, and attitudes. In the basement, the store consciousness, are all the potential thoughts and feelings. In our tradition, there are 51 categories of mental formations. Describing the mental formations, the metaphor of seeds is used. The word bija is the word for seeds in Sanskrit, B-I-J-A. Each of us contains every seed in the form of potential. The potential for every kind of thought and feeling that leads to words and actions reside in each one of us in our store consciousness, hanging out in our basement. We all have the potential to be a saint or a serial killer. It all depends on which seeds are watered. In a recent mailing, Jack Kornfield wrote, "The great writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, 'The line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being.' This understanding doesn't excuse harm or ask us to ignore injustice. Rather, it frees us from the illusion that some people are beyond redemption, while others are beyond reproach. We all carry fear and love, confusion and wisdom. The practice is to strengthen what is wise and compassionate until it becomes the force that guides our lives." When a seed is touched and watered, she grows and appears in our living room. She manifests in mind consciousness and becomes a mental formation. The ninth exercise is to recognize any kind of mental formation that manifests, whether it is compassion or fear, anger or mindfulness. Thay describes the process of meditation in this way. Our mind is a river of mental formations, and each mental formation is a drop of water in that river. To meditate is to sit on the bank of the river and observe and recognize each mental formation as it manifests. You observe and smile to the mental formation without being carried away by it. You can watch it arrive, allow it to stay for some time, and watch it go. Now, we each have triggers that cause our seeds of fear or anger to manifest, to become excited and grow until they appear in our living room, our conscious mind. These triggers come from our environment, from our past, our ancestors, and from our society, from school and family and religion and community. Perhaps I hear something that triggers my anger, while the person next to me isn't triggered at all. I have a sensitivity to what was said because of all the conditions in my life so far and from my ancestral and epigenetic inheritance. When a negative mental formation gets watered, it manifests in our mind. But here's the trick of the practice in two steps. With the first step, we notice it without judging or reacting. Ah, fear, my old friend, I see you there. When the presence of the mental formation has been acknowledged and honored, step two is to gently surround and envelop it with your mindfulness and invite it to return down to the basement, back to your store consciousness. We're not trying to get rid of anything because we know everything is part of us. But we can choose what manifests by taking good care of ourselves with our attention and discernment. This is called appropriate attention. When the food that nourishes our seeds of well-being are present, this is what we'll experience. When our attention is inappropriate, seeds of fear and anger and despair may be watered, and this is what we find in our living room. This becomes our reality. As students of the Buddha, we can train ourselves to develop appropriate attention. We can fill our environment with thoughts and feelings which promote peace, hope, and connection in us, and we will become beacons for others who haven't been trained in this way. This is one of the most important gifts we can give to others right now. When we're in a bad environment, we don't have much chance for appropriate attention. And what we touch, what we see, what we hear will activate the worst in us, like craving, anger, and despair. When we produce a thought of hate, of discrimination, of despair, it will destroy our physical and mental health, and it will destroy our world. Mindfulness is one mental formation taking care of another mental formation. When you know how to do this, you're much safer. The Buddha is there in the form of your mindfulness and will protect you from being carried away by unhelpful mental formations. You can also invite your seeds of compassion and understanding to your living room to add to this tea party of transformation. When you learn to do this, to use your mindfulness, compassion, and understanding to transform your fear, despair, and anger, Thay says you're a skilled practitioner, a good student of the Buddha. So you have the capacity of bringing relief to your feelings, to your emotions. These two steps lead to the deep practice of transforming negative mental formations by identifying and embracing the roots of suffering and using our concentration and insight to bring compassion and understanding. This is called transformation at the base. I have to admit that even after almost 30 years of practice, I still find it hard not to react when I'm triggered. It feels intrinsic to my survival. What I have found is that there are many other ways to protect myself, like what we're talking about here, to make sure my inner environment promotes well-being, to learn to turn my mind to what is good, to develop my joy and ease and gratitude, to release limited views about myself and others, and to cultivate love and beauty every day. All these practices protect me from my tendency to be triggered. Exercise 10 is called gladdening the mind. Breathing in, I make my mind happy. Breathing out, I make my mind happy. This 10th exercise is to make the landscape of our mind more beautiful. We have to water the good seeds in our store consciousness so they'll manifest in our mind. In our store consciousness are all the seeds of positive mental formations, like faith, confidence, good energy, mindfulness, concentration, insight, loving kindness, compassion, joy, non-discrimination, and so on. The seed of enlightenment, the seed of liberation, the seed of happiness, the seed of loving kindness are all there. The 10th exercise is the practice of watering them so they have a chance to manifest. The 19th century Baptist preacher Charles Spurgeon says, "Good thoughts are blessed guests and should be heartily welcomed, well fed, and much sought after. Like rose leaves, they give out a sweet smell if laid up in the jar of memory." Tai tells us that it's so sad if the living room of your mind is occupied only by the people you don't like. He says, you don't want them there, but they just push in the door and enter. Your living room is not a pleasant place to be. So we train to invite only the guests that bring happiness and well-being. When you listen to a Dharma talk or practice sitting or walking meditation or enjoy time outdoors or listen to beautiful music or chanting, the seed of joy, the seed of happiness are watered and they manifest. All the things you do that touch joy, happiness, beauty, and delight water the beneficial seeds in you. When we feel the seeds of craving or loneliness in us, we have a tendency to distract ourselves in unwholesome ways, including endlessly scrolling on our phones or turning to the refrigerator or to Netflix. But these activities don't water the seeds we want, so they don't bring us the experience of life we're seeking. It's like when our bodies need zinc, but instead we feed them copper. It just exacerbates the problem. They don't lead us to the present moment and to the awareness of our true goodness. It's all about mindful consuming, because what we feed ourselves is what we become. When you nourish the good seeds, they manifest in your living room and you have a lovely group of friends there. When you nourish the negative seeds like fear, hate, despair, delusion, and doubt, you will find yourself with a nasty bunch of folks hanging out in your mind. We all have genes that we've inherited that give us tendencies to certain mental formations. We may have a tendency towards depression or anger, towards joy or caring for others. But the Buddha teaches that nothing can survive without food. What is in your living room is what is being fed. If you ever wonder really what your beliefs are, just look at your living room, at your mind consciousness. You may find energies that you don't want in your space, but they are there because of your habit energies formed from your personal and collective history. As a practitioner, you now have the choice to invite these habits to go back down to your basement and instead to invite up wholesome energies. Neuroscientists tell us that genes don't turn on by themselves, the environment turns them on. What is being fed is what manifests. We can use this insight to see where our fear and anger come from, and also what happens when we feed our seeds of love and compassion and joy. We need to look at our environment and make changes before transformation can happen. Tai teaches, if you know how to look deeply into your suffering and identify the sources of food that has developed it, then you know what to do. When you cut out that food, healing begins immediately and you are on the path of liberation. Your suffering will die because nothing can survive without food. So the ninth and tenth exercises are practiced with the awareness and conviction that nothing can survive without food. Good food will nourish the positive tendencies, and bad food will nourish the negative. Neuroscientist and Dharma teacher Rick Hansen says, "The brain is the organ that learns, designed by evolution to be changed by our experiences. What scientists call experience-dependent neuroplasticity. Neurons that fire together wire together. This means that each one of us has the power to use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better." Lasting traits from experiences of inner strength that get installed into the brain. You become more grateful through internalizing repeated experiences of gratitude. You become more compassionate through internalizing repeated experiences of compassion. Without this installation, the transfer of the beneficial experience from short-term memory buffers to long-term storage are momentarily pleasant, but they have no lasting effect. Meanwhile, your brain is rapidly and efficiently turning unpleasant negative experiences into the neural structure of your brain because we have a negativity bias that helped us to survive. So most of us are pretty good at having beneficial experiences, but perhaps not so good at installing them in the brain, so they actually change the pathway of the brain. We were gifted a Plum Village practice by Dharma teacher Glenn Schneider called the 10 Breaths for Happiness. We've done this many times in the past. I love this practice. It focuses on installing our positive experiences and creating a positivity bias in our brains. It involves the two aspects of installation. First, being aware that we're enjoying the moment, metacognition, and second, staying with it for at least 10 breaths. Neuroscientists have identified how this process works to change the brain. We want to not only have the positive experience, we want our brains to evolve from it. So let's practice that now. Look around the space you're in and find something of beauty or meaning to focus on. Like a flower, your favorite mug, a sleeping pet, a piece of art, or a pillow or a blanket you love. Now become aware of your in-breath and out-breath as you simply rest your attention on this loved object. You are aware of your intention to gladden your mind as you experience the happiness it brings you, and you are aware of your breathing. So installing those moments of happiness is a way of evolving our brains from the negativity bias to the positivity bias. I think that's some of the basic work we're doing for not only ourselves, but for humanity. So the 11th and 12th exercises, concentrating the mind and liberating the mind. Breathing in, I concentrate my mind. Breathing out, I concentrate my mind. Breathing in, I liberate my mind. Breathing out, I liberate my mind. The 11th and 12th exercises go together. This is samadhi. Breathing in, I concentrate my mind. And I practice looking deeply into the nature of the mental formation that's there. I can see its roots, especially the nutriment that has brought it to me. Concentration is the powerful instrument that has the power to liberate, to transform. Thay says, meditation, dhyana, is described as the energy to burn, to transform. Suppose we have a lens receiving the sun's rays. The lens helps us to create a concentration of energy, and it gets very hot. If you put a piece of paper under the lens, it will burn up. In the same way, you can put your affliction under the lamp of concentration, and with understanding, with insight, you can liberate yourself from that affliction. So the power of mindfulness and concentration will bring about the power of insight. And the insight as fire will burn away the affliction, whether it is depression or hate or fear. And there's another aspect of concentration. One of the phrases in our tradition is, in concentration, my heart is at peace. It's a relaxed aspect of concentration that comes when we let go of distractions, when our mind rests simply on one thing. Here's a quote from a wise ancestor. In a letter to his son on April 14, 1747, the fourth Earl of Chesterfield, Philip Dormer Stanhope, said, "There is time enough for everything in the course of the day if you do but one thing at once. But there is not time enough in the year if you will do two things at a time." We have Western roots for mindfulness too. When we let go of multitasking, when we're able to rest our awareness on one thing and keep it there, we feel a sense of calm and ease. We're able to touch the beauty and joy within and around us, to witness the miracles that are always happening. Thay says that diligence is always accompanied by ease. To fully understand samadhi, concentration, we need to bring these two aspects together. At our Peaceful Refuge Sangha gathering last week, Sandra wisely reminded us that Thay instructs us to become the object of attention. In the companion sutra to this one, The Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha instructs us to observe the body in the body, the feelings in the feelings, the mind in the mind, and the objects of mind in the objects of mind. What does this mean, the mind in the mind? Well, there are some who practice awareness of breathing by looking at their breath from the outside of their body, or even just by thinking about their breathing. The instructions indicate that instead, we need to become the object of our attention. We need to immerse ourselves from the inside. And this way of concentration is deeply restful and satisfying. If you've ever seen our teacher walking, you'll know what I mean. If you haven't, please find a video or film of Thay walking. Many people have had awakening experiences just by watching him walk across a courtyard. When the Zen teacher Richard Baker Roshi had this experience, he described Thay as a cross between a tractor and a cloud. The penetrating depth of concentration with the lightness of a truly free person. When we walk as a free person, our mind liberated from distraction, we can have a similar impact on our world. So in exercise 9, we're simply noticing. We're learning to be Homo sapiens sapiens, aware of the contents of our mind in any moment. With exercise 10, we remember that we have a choice where to focus our attention, and we practice cultivating wholesome seeds in our consciousness. With exercise 11, we develop our concentration, resting firmly or lightly on the object of attention that we choose and merging with it. And with exercise 12, we're liberated from unwholesome thoughts and habitual tendencies of the mind to make us miserable. At first, to me, exercises 11 and 12 seemed the most action-oriented, the juiciest ones. However, in my experience, the practices that reap the most benefits are the ones that train me to slow down, to settle my fast energy, and teach me to wholly inhabit one moment at a time. When this happens, and it usually takes a bit of time, when I settle down and the calm arises, I naturally focus on one thing at a time, and my heart lightens into freedom. This is one of the many reasons why it's good to occasionally practice in longer sessions, ideally with the Sangha. I found that our weekly times together help settle and ground and refresh me, but to deeply rest and transform, I usually need a longer time. In Fa Pai's book on the Eight Realizations of Great Beings, he quotes a translation of the Anapanasati Sutra, that's the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which says, "When the body and mind of a practitioner drenched in joy grow calm, then ease as a factor for awakening becomes awakened." Well, this just gobsmacked me. Drenched in joy. I've never heard that phrase before in a sutra. Let's take a moment, return to our conscious breathing, and visualize ourselves being drenched in joy. You can remember a moment when you felt this way, or you can visualize a rainbow of light drenching your mind and body with beauty and joy, or you can just invite in that feeling. Feel your body drenched in joy. Feel the lightness of your heart when it's drenched in joy. In this moment, you are liberated from suffering, from distraction, from ideas and notions. You rest in the ease of the moment. When we're liberated, when we're free, what are we free from? From identifying with our suffering as us. The Four Noble Truths show us that our suffering has roots, and when we identify those roots, we can cut them off and become free of them. We have choice. And when we choose to lean into what's happening in the moment, we can always choose to focus on the basic goodness that is at the heart of every moment and every person. As students of the Buddha, this is how we train. The other practice of the Buddha I'd like to teach you tonight is right diligence, which is one of the Noble Eightfold Paths. I love this teaching because it's so obvious and at the same time so profound. It goes well with the teaching on mind and store consciousness, as it's an extremely concrete way to nourish our happiness, to drench ourselves in joy. There are four aspects to right diligence. Thay likes to teach right diligence with examples from relationships, which reminds us that we don't practice in a vacuum and we don't practice only for ourselves. The first aspect of right diligence is to refrain from watering the negative seeds that are in your store consciousness. Don't give them any food or any attention. It's an art to organize our life in such a way that the seeds of fear, anger, craving, and despair in us are not fed. The practice of the fifth mindfulness training, mindful consumption, is very important. When you eat junk food, watch television, or go onto social media, the harmful seeds in your store consciousness may be watered. After a steady diet like this, someone may turn into an angry or depressed person. We have to create an environment so the negative seeds are not watered in ourselves and in our loved ones. Tai reminds us to only water the good seeds in our partner, to refrain from watering the seeds of jealousy, anger, and fear in our loved ones. As partners, we can each make the commitment to not only take care of our own environment, but also to honor our partner's environment by seeing and offering nourishment for the goodness in them. Many years ago, Tai created a document called a peace treaty that partners could sign, committing to this aspiration. When you make this commitment in your relationship, you become more careful in what you choose to say and not say. If you run your words through the filter of only nourishing the good seeds in your partner, you may find that you choose to refrain from saying many things. Many years ago, Robert and I worked at the same small, dysfunctional company. Each day we'd leave work, come home, and start venting about what had happened that day. We finally realized that we were compounding the misery, and yet we felt the need to share our suffering. So we made a rule that we could only talk about work for the first 30 minutes, and after that, we had to stop watering those seeds of misery in ourselves and each other. Several years later, when practicing this, one time I noticed that Robert had left a light on overnight a few times. At first, I thought reminding him would be helpful, but he just got irritated when I did, so I decided not to say anything about it and instead just turn off the light myself. Communication has always been very important to me. My lineage name is True Spiritual Communication, but I learned that the best way to communicate sometimes is to remain silent, to refrain from correcting or instructing, even when well-intentioned. The second aspect is for when a negative seed has already manifested. Tai says a good practitioner should know how to help it return to store consciousness as quickly as possible. One way to do this is to invite a wholesome, beautiful seed to come up. Instead of focusing on the negative seed, feed the wholesome seed with all your attention. Then the negative one will not have the food it needs to manifest, so it will return to the basement. When a seed of anger or fear or sorrow manifests, don't let it take over and become its victim. Change the channel. Invite something good to happen. You can do that for yourself, and you can help your beloved one do that. With your energy and your kindness, you can help the good things in your beloved to come up. We help each other. At Peaceful Refuge Sangha, not long ago, there was a question about what spiritual bypass means. The second aspect of diligence can look like spiritual bypass if we're not careful, which is ignoring or denying the suffering arising in us. But we know that our practice is to become aware of our suffering and to take good care of it. Tai even calls it the art of suffering. He says when we know the art of suffering, we will suffer much less. That's what we're learning here. So after acknowledging and honoring our suffering, we can choose to focus our attention elsewhere. We don't have to allow our suffering to take over the whole living room. And the third aspect of right diligence is, if there's a wholesome seed that has not yet manifested, do something to help it manifest. We have so many good things in us. We have the capacity to love, to forgive, to be free and creative, to be joyful, to understand. But often we don't allow these seeds to grow, these chromosomes transmitted to us by the Buddha, by Jesus, by our spiritual ancestors. Tai reminds us that we already have the kingdom of God within us. We have nirvana. Psychologist Rick Hansen suggests asking ourselves, what else might help? As a way to imagine beneficial aspects that we've not yet cultivated in ourselves. Again, with this training, we help our beloved ones, our friends and partners to water the good seeds in themselves so their beauty will manifest. We use the concept of selective watering, only choosing to acknowledge and encourage the wholesome aspects. Tai says you can make someone happy in 5 minutes if you know how to water the seed of happiness in them. In my community, I like to engage with someone I meet by commenting on something attractive they're wearing or on their smile. This is a simple way of expressing appreciation for someone showing up and being who they are. It doesn't take much, and it makes me happy. When we practice together as a Sangha, we know that the energy produced helps the good seeds in us to manifest into our mind consciousness and become good mental formations. Then the landscape of our mind is beautiful and joyful. Gladdening the mind is the practice. And the last training in diligence is, once the wholesome seed has manifested in the mind, try to keep it there as long as possible, because it will continue to make the landscape of the mind happy and beautiful. It's like when you have a good friend visiting, giving you much joy and happiness. You try to keep her with you as long as possible. Install that energy of well-being into the neural pathways of your brain so your attention becomes an act of evolution. When a good practitioner keeps a good mental formation alive in the mind, happiness grows. And down in the store consciousness, the seed of compassion also continues to grow. Feeding good seeds in our minds also encourages those good seeds to grow in our store consciousness. That is another aspect of the practice of transformation at the base. James Clear, who's the author of the wildly popular book called Atomic Habits, talks about the food we nourish ourselves with in this way. He says, getting what you want in life largely boils down to the story you tell yourself and where you direct your attention. He says, what story do you tell yourself about what has happened to you, about what you're capable of and what you hope to achieve? Is the conversation in your head each day empowering and encouraging or holding you back? And are you taking control and directing your attention towards what matters or merely letting inertia pull you along? Most things don't matter and most actions won't deliver a result. Focus. Master your internal monologue and master your daily attention. Most tips, tricks, and tactics ultimately come back to these two things. I've shared this before with some of you, but a phrase that he overheard was, if you choose not to find joy in the snow, you'll have the less joy in your life, but still the same amount of snow. So awareness of the contents of our mind leads to our ability to make our minds happy, which leads to concentration, which allows the ease with which we liberate ourselves from suffering. So let's all practice with these four exercises over the next few months. So I'd like to end with a poem, as I often do. This one's by Rosemary Wattola Traumer called Generous Assumptions. I would like to open my heart to you and keep it open, but the truth is, sometimes all it takes is a glance, or the lack of a glance, or a certain tone, or a serrated word, and instantly the heart puts on its armor, which is something like a coat of porcupine quills, only the quills go inward too, and the instant I wear it, I'm aware of how much it hurts to wear it. How in that moment, when I seek to protect myself, I wound myself. What if I believed you're doing the best you can, considering the forces that have shaped you? What if I listened past your words, looked through your actions to see how you too feel threatened? The Buddha said we are always moving toward or away from freedom. Could I, in that moment, before the prickly coat has started doing its prickly work, could I move toward freedom by refusing to put it on? Could I choose instead the silken robe of generous assumptions, the one that allows for compassion, connection, even kindness toward you, toward myself? Already, just thinking about it being possible, I notice a softening, a curiosity about how I might change not you, but myself. Already, I feel how fluid this robe is, how gently it swirls around me, how strong its fibers are, how freeing it is, cool and breezy, this gift to myself. So, dear friends, I know how much you like homework. So here are some suggestions for homework as we practice over the next period of time until the fourth quarter. First, when this gets posted on the website, and thanks to Dennis for that, you may want to listen to it again because there's a lot of practical steps in this teaching that you might want to go over. And some other suggestions I have is, so you meditate, please do meditate with each of these four exercises in the mindfulness of mind, awareness of mind. Approaching the workings of your mind with curiosity and openness. Rest on the bank of the river as you observe the coming together and letting go of your thoughts. We did this yesterday, actually, in my weekly meditation group, and a woman who is a worrier and has a lot of challenges with happiness. At the end of the time when we did this practice, this guided meditation of being on the bank of the river, she raised her hand and she said, "I feel wonderful." So I felt like, okay, great, let's all just do this for a while. Now, and then we can practice selective watering and appropriate attention. So notice where you're placing your attention and realize you have a choice. Select the most beneficial areas to place your attention and choose to place it there. You might stop several times through a day and ask, what is my attention focused on right now? Is it beneficial and nourishing to my awakening? Train yourself to use energy to increase what's beneficial and to surround your unbeneficial tendencies with mindfulness, allowing them to return to dormancy. Remember, if you cut off their food supply, they will go back to your basement. Experiment with this changing a habit, like watching the news first thing in the morning or last thing at night, or any habit that doesn't nourish the best in you. Maybe listen to a favorite piece of music instead. Also, you can ask the question from Rick Hansen, what else might help? Responses to this question might surprise us. Be open to new ways to use your imagination and curiosity. Set an intention to be filled with delight, to be drenched in joy. Make your living room an inviting place to visit. And also, explore the various aspects of samadhi. What does it feel like in your body, in your heart, in your mind, when you merge with and become the object of your attention? Can you experience both penetrating clarity and ease with all that is at the same time? So those are my suggestions for you. And I know that there will be a lot more ideas from all of you as you practice with this rich teaching from the Buddha and from Thay. So This is the first time I think I've ended before we're completely out of time. Would anyone like to make any comments or questions or anything like that? The floor is open for a minute or two if you do. I like sitting here with all of you. So, if we feel complete, are there any announcements? Tim probably has one.
Thank you, Barbara. In our sangha, we call him Tim Nounsen. Tim Nounsen. Yes, we Tiger Mountain Sangha has a morning of mindfulness on August 29th in Woodinville at Lily's house. Everyone is invited if you'd like to come. I know it's very far for people from Oregon, but for those of us that are closer or who might be around, make sure and send us an email so we know that we have some idea of how many people are going to show up. And after about a short break, when we wrap up this, we will open up the regular Tiger Mountain Sangha link, Zoom link, for reflections and sharings about how the Dharma rain has nourished us from Barbara's teaching. So look forward to seeing you at either or both.
Thank you, Tim. Also, tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. West Coast time, there's a celebration of life for Dharma teacher Larry Ward. It's the 1 year anniversary of his passing tomorrow, August 19th, and there are going to be a lot of people there sharing and reading poems and telling stories and practicing together. And so everyone's welcome. If you haven't signed up for it, but you'd like to participate, just go to lotusinstitute.org and you'll be able to do that. So, yeah. Is there anything else?
What time is that?
Pardon me,
What
Karen? What's what?
Time is that?
4 p.m. tomorrow. Yeah. Okay, dear friends, if we are done, complete, we can offer the merits of our practice. May the merits of this practice benefit all beings and bring